Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. A movement often begins with a single person, sometimes two. In 1970, as the bloody war in Vietnam divided the country, college campuses continued to erupt in violent protest. But one aspect of the war transcended politics. Cal State Northridge student Carol Bates and her friend Kay Hunter, who attended UCLA, were increasingly disturbed by the plight of American POWs and MIAs. No one wanted to talk about these servicemen or their families who suffered in silence back home. It would be decades before social media gave new meaning to the word viral. But in that simpler time, Bates and Hunter devised an idea that quickly struck a chord with millions of people across the country. The POW bracelet. Perhaps you had one. Perhaps you knew a serviceman whose name was engraved into gold or copper. Embraced by a diverse group of celebrities, including John Wayne, Sonny and Cher, and Johnny Carson, the unlikely cultural phenomenon united the country at a time of deep division, bringing new awareness to the issue of American warriors lost behind enemy lines. It also fundamentally altered the arc of Carol Bates Brown's life.
When I was real young, we lived in Inglewood, down by the L.A. airport, and then we moved in San Fernando Valley in 1960, so I was 12 years old then. But, it was a typical suburban kind of life, nice ranch houses. We walked to school and was in Girl Scouts and Brownies and that kind of thing. So I had a sister who was 2 years younger than I was, and she was a tomboy, and I was the one with dolls, and she had cars and trucks and guns. So it was an interesting relationship, but I had a very good childhood. I really can't complain.
What did you learn from your mom and dad? What was the most valuable lesson?
Probably to always tell the truth. My mother convinced me when I was little that she could tell when I was lying, so that it was not worth doing because I'd get in big trouble, caught lying. So that was certainly one thing I learned. I think also to respect authority and live by the rules, play by the rules, that kind of thing. They were very law-abiding, did not do bad things ever. So, my mother did a lot of volunteer work at various points throughout her life. And my father worked hard. He was a tool and die maker. And so they had a lot of friends, and they partied and did things like that, and we always went on vacation someplace. My father loved the mountains, and My grandfather had a cabin up there for many years near Los Angeles in Lake Arrowhead. And so we'd go there in the summer and the winter sometimes. And my mother loved the beach, so we would always spend a lot of time at the beach. And so I had a very nice childhood.
What did you dream about when you were a young girl?
Oh, my goodness. I have no idea. I didn't dream about it, but I became interested in politics at a very young age. My mother was involved in politics as a volunteer, and it was often talked about at, say, family gatherings or whatever. They would talk about politics and things. They were very staunch Republicans coming from Orange County, California, which used to be very conservative, and that's where my parents were born. And I was actually a fourth-generation Californian, so there was a lot of California there. Anyway, but they were staunch Republicans, so I would hear bad things about President Roosevelt. Of course, he was long dead and gone. But and I can remember reporting to my mother once that one of the neighbors wasn't going to vote for President Eisenhower for re-election, and I just thought that was horrible. So I was interested in politics, and we lived when I was real young in Richard Nixon's congressional district, and one of my mother's cousins had worked with Pat at the high school, and the Nixons had two little girls who were very close to the ages of my sister and I, and their oldest daughter was blonde and fair, and the younger daughter had dark hair, and that was the same way my sister and I were. So as a little girl, I really identified with those two little girls, and I would see them on television or something from time to time. So I guess that helped get me kind of interested in politics.
So when you got to a certain age, you didn't rebel against authority, right?
No, I didn't. And
even though all your peers were.
That's right, yes. I was not a hippie. I was not a drug user. I was not rebellious at all. That was my sister's job, as it turned out. But not me. I was so squeaky clean. I joined a sorority in college, and which was a good thing to do. But by that time, on the college campuses, there was enormous unrest. I started college in 1966, and the Communist Party had tables there registering kids to join up and sign on. You know, when you go to registration, there's all kinds of clubs and things you can sign up for, and they were signing up people. And what had happened was, where I went to school, it was in the suburbs, and it was about 20 miles from UCLA. And Berkeley had already had a lot of problems up in Northern California. And they decided to organize in the suburbs instead of going to UCLA to organize and radicalize that school right off. They decided to pick this school. And we had kids that went to Cuba every summer to work with Fidel Castro. And so there was just constant turmoil on campus for the entire time I was there.
How did that protest movement, you know, seeing it up close, seeing it on television, how did that affect you as a kid?
Well, as a student there at school, it affected me a great deal. Sometimes the radical students would come in and close down your classrooms and stuff and say school was over for the day. I was a member of the Young Republicans also, and we didn't take this too well. I became active and involved with students from other colleges, which is what eventually led me into the POW/MIA thing, because there were a lot of kids I met through Young Republicans. Some of them were in various different organizations, and all of us were very upset by what was going on in the college campuses and wanted to find ways to make it stop. And of course, a lot of it had to was directed in, the excuse was the anti-war protest, but we got involved to the local police department, and I can't even remember how on earth I got involved with them, but one time a friend of mine convinced me to go to this meeting of the Students for Democratic Society. There had been a riot at school that day. Lots of kids and people had been arrested. My girlfriend and I went, and we were so upset by what happened that we went out to find the police, and all we had to do was drive on campus and at night, and we were surrounded by the Los Angeles Police Department. So we told them what was going on, and we told them that at this meeting it was the kids were going to have this demonstration the next day in the open square area. They were bringing baseball bats. They were bringing their children so the police wouldn't hurt them, and that they were going to maybe try to kill the president of the college. They'd already had some situations where I think he'd been taken hostage once already. There'd been a long stream of really horrible things going on in school. And so we told him anyway. So the next thing you know, in the morning, I wake up and my mother wakes me up and she says, you know, I think the governor, Governor Reagan at the time, has called a state of emergency at your school and the National Guard's been mobilized and surrounding the school. And I think you might have something to do with this. And it was like, yeah, I might. And so my girlfriend and I, we went to school that day, and the people did amass, and of course the National Guard and the police rounded up the protesters and the demonstrators, and a bunch of kids were arrested. Well, and some professors. What ended up happening was nobody was ever prosecuted, I don't think, because the police told the judge that the witnesses were two young girls and they were not safe if they were brought into the court or anything else. So it would be unsafe for us. So they dropped all the charges. So anyway, that was my, so much of my life at school became involved with horrible things like that. I did still go to school, and I was still in my sorority, but it was kind of a mess.
Did you understand that you were different from a lot of these kids who thought about the world very different than you?
Well, it wasn't just different from that. Most of the kids weren't involved in any of it at all. They were going on about their lives. They were getting their education. There was the few hardcore radicals on one hand, and there were a few of us on the other hand. And I used to become very frustrated with the women in my sorority because they'd be talking about Sigma Chi Derby Day, and, you know, they're burning down buildings in the school. And it really upset me that I didn't feel they were dealing in a whole lot of reality. So I was very frustrated that way. But really, most of the students kind of just tried to ignore it and go about their lives. I found one way. I started taking some night classes, which was better because things were calm at night, and the people at night classes were people who usually worked in the day, and they were maybe a little older, and they weren't at all interested, and so you could have a decent class or something at night. And I was a journalism major, which of course was during the day, but I also was political science major, and a lot of those classes, taking them at night was far more productive, and we actually had better professors because they were more grown-ups and not into radical behavior, and they had experience in politics.
How did you meet Kay Hunter?
Through the Young Republicans. I'm not sure when I met her or exactly where, but she went to UCLA, and we became friends, and we participated in any number of political events and stuff, and a lot of the older Republican clubs liked us and some of our friends because they wanted to see young people come And the Beverly Hills Republicans particularly, because there weren't, all the young people were portrayed as crazy radicals and hippies and things. And
it was not cool to be a young Republican.
No, it was not. It was not. But we got invited to all the, you know, $100, $500 a plate dinners because people would say, well, donate some of my tickets to students to come. Well, we were always the students that got rounded up to come. So it became an interesting phenomenon for us, I guess.
Who was Bob Dornan, and how did he change your life?
Bob Dornan, at the time, had a local television talk show. I guess it was on Saturday nights in Los Angeles. And he was a conservative guy and pro-military and all, and he'd been to Vietnam several times as a civilian. And he featured, I know, a returned POW, a guy that was released early, and he had him on his TV show. But somehow I met Bob Dornan through politics, possibly at some of these political gatherings that we went to. But he later became a member of Congress and was quite well known as B-1 Bob, pushing the B-1 bomber, portions which were, I think, being built, certainly parts of it, at least in his district. But he had a... he, at a political event, he brought with him three women whose husbands were missing in action in Vietnam. And this was, I believe, in late 69. And he introduced us to these women, and the women were starting work on a letter-writing campaign and petition campaigns to try to draw public attention. And this was the first time, you know, I had ever thought about or heard about prisoners of war missing in action in Vietnam, because you heard about the anti-war thing, and I wasn't really involved in knowing that much about the war. My friends were in college, so they weren't serving in Vietnam. They weren't drafted, and I just really didn't know anybody that had gone to the war, and so it wasn't something I thought about a lot as a war. Anyway, so Kay and I met these women, and we said, wow, this would be a really good thing. By this time, I was involved with a group called Viva, and we had been trying to fight the unrest on college campuses, and we were doing a lot of public speaking about the problems on the campuses because of the radicals and how they were closing down the schools and all. And we tried to discourage kids from participating in it, and so we thought maybe that was something we could do. Bob Dornan, at some point during this period or shortly thereafter, talked to us about a little bracelet he wore that he'd gotten from the Montagnards in Vietnam, and that he would wear it to remember the lives they were having, the problems they were having, and that the terrible life of normal Vietnamese, or a Vietnamese in this case, that were a minority that was particularly having a very rough time because of the war. And we thought, wow, that's cool and stuff. And at some point, Kay and I decided, wouldn't it be cool? We could go to Vietnam and get a Montagnard bracelet like Bob's, and then we could remember it, wear it to remember the POWs and MIAs. And when people ask us why we have this stupid little bracelet on.
What did your parents think about that idea?
My parents, like, were really horrified about that. My mother had been very pleased she'd had two daughters, and we weren't going to be drafted. The idea of going to Vietnam wasn't going to even start. Kay's parents wouldn't have gone for it either. Kay's father was a leading cardiologist in the area. There was no way in life we were going to Vietnam. And so we decided maybe we could do something to get some sort of bracelets. And Kay really pursued this point. And she went out, and I remember she got a life alert bracelet, those little metal bracelets people used to wear that had diabetes particularly, and that you could engrave. And we thought about getting something, a little chain or something we could wear. And she pursued suit it sort of that way. So we wanted to get some sort of weird-looking bracelet or odd bracelet to wear to remember the POWs and MIAs. And that was pretty much it. And we just thought after a while, well, gee, you know, maybe if we had some, maybe other kids would want to wear them too. And which led us with, and this is where our the lady who was the chairman of Viva, who was a grown-up, she really took the bull by the horns, and she found a man who did engraving on silver that they used to decorate horses for parades, and he was locally nearby there in Santa Monica, and he, I can remember being at Gloria's house. Her name was Gloria Coppin, this lady, and she were on the phone and stuff, and we were talking about, we would put the name of the man, and somebody had come up with the idea, and it might have even been Bob Dornan and Gloria together, of putting the date of loss on the bracelet, too. So we had this 10 bracelets, I believe it was, that this man made for us, and they were nickel-plated, and they were used as prototypes to try to draw some funding to get these bracelets made in somewhat larger quantities.
And you knocked on a lot of doors, right, to raise money for that?
Well, we tried to find some people with money to put in, and very honestly, we went to Ross Perot, who was well-known at that point for supporting POW issues, and tried to deliver gifts for the prisoners to Vietnam at Christmas time and this kind of thing, which, of course, the Vietnamese wouldn't let him do. But but Perot didn't want to touch it. He didn't really want to touch anything that wasn't his project. So we actually even went through Gloria Coppin's husband was involved in aircraft manufacturing and knew people in the Hughes Company. And so we went to in Howard Hughes's. He was still alive in those days. And we went to Las Vegas. Gloria and I went to Las Vegas to meet with the man who was Hughes's like number one or number two guy. And they kind of thanked us very much, but they didn't want to be involved either. Howard Hughes did, and his people did, support the women, I have to say, in Las Vegas, the POW MIA wives in Las Vegas at the time. They were very supportive of and donated to help them fund activities and things. Now, where it was going to be.
How did you explain? What was your pitch?
Well, you know, that it, what we told people is that we wanted to have them so that you could, they would draw public attention to the plight of the missing, and the idea was you would wear it until the guy came home. I don't know that we had a long, massive pitch, and you have to, and at this point, we're talking about 50 years ago, and I honestly don't remember the details of our pitch, but what ended up happening was Gloria Coppin's husband donated some metal for us to make, I don't know, I think it was like maybe 1,500 bracelets or whatever, and there was some copper. We made some in copper because people in those days wore them. They thought it helped their tennis elbow or something. And then we had, the other ones were actually nickel-plated brass. And so these bracelets were made, these initial bracelets, and we got a little card that went with them that told about the bracelet and all. And we thought, well, you know, some kid, we really thought college kids and high school kids maybe would like these things. We never, in our wildest dreams, believed, certainly I didn't at that point, that it would take off to be anything big or that we would actually distribute, I think, what was 5 million bracelets, roughly.
5 million.
And adults would wear them.
Yeah, I mean, John Wayne had one of these, right?
Yes, he did.
Lots of celebrities, people who are good friends of mine today had these. When did you understand that you were doing something that was touching a vein with people across the country?
Well, I think we went in the fall of 1970 to a League of Families meeting in Washington, D.C., and several of us from Viva went to it. And families there were clamoring to sign up to have their man's name put on these bracelets. Before that, we'd not had a lot of different names because we didn't do it unless we pretty much had permission from the man's family. And so people were clamoring to sign up for it. And I came back from Washington, and these bracelets were just going out the door.
How did you get the word out?
About the bracelets? Well, it was pretty much starting kind of word of mouth. We did have a news conference in L.A. in November of 70, introducing the program and all. And, we had, I'm thinking, was that, I don't know if that was the Christmas or if it was the next Christmas. We had Bob Hope take some to Vietnam, and we had people going with him on his big Christmas show, and they took a box of bracelets. That probably was the next year. But it was really started word of mouth. And then, you know, Bob Dornan again came through on his television show. He gave an enormous amount of publicity and promotion from his television show. And so that got a lot of people involved. And we had families, of course, wanting the bracelets. They were handing them out to people. We had, we wanted to get somebody on the Tonight Show. Johnny Carson was the host in those days, and it would come to Los Angeles and film a few weeks a year. And it was in L.A., and Gloria knew a number of people in the entertainment business, and she was eventually able to get, they said if we could get a big enough star to come on and talk about the bracelets, they would talk about the bracelets. So Gloria set to work, got Charlton Heston to go on the show and talk about the bracelets. So that drew
Moses,
a lot of people.
You got Moses to go on and talk about the bracelets.
We did. We did indeed, yes. And a few days later, some of the staff from the Tonight Show showed up in our little old rickety office, and they were interested in, and they took more bracelets back to New York with them. And in fact, one of the women that showed up became a very close friend of mine. It just mushroomed all over the country. At one, Martha Ray and Bob Hope were co-chairman of the, honorary co-chairman of the bracelet program with me. And Martha Ray was really involved in promoting it. And she was traveling all over the country in dinner theater performances and stuff. And she'd take box of bracelets with her and give them away or sell them or collect money. And she'd come back to her home, which was near our office in L.A. And somebody would call and go up to her house and take more bracelets and get the money and come back. And it just kept growing and growing and growing, unbelievably so. And, I mean, it was way out of control. We couldn't make enough bracelets. I don't know how technical you want to get here, but we ended up having to get another company, obviously. This wonderful man who was making them continued to make them, but we got a big company that could photo engrave the names and could run a lot at one time because, I mean, we were getting at one point 30,000 pieces of mail a day into our office.
And you were selling these for about $3, right? And reinvesting that money in the cause.
Right. They were $2.50 for nickel one and $3 for copper, which was a mistake on our part, obviously, because kids would send their $2 and their 50 cents in the envelopes and stuff. And actually, yes, the money did get back into the cause. But, I mean, it also brought with us problems that we were certainly not prepared to handle, like the post office was stealing our mail. On several occasions, bags of mail were stolen en route from the post office, and people called and said, there's a bag of mail burning on my front lawn, and it was our mail, and it was, so we actually hired Brinks to pick up all the mail, and it was taken to a bank where all the mail was opened and all the money was taken out. By then, we'd had to hire a fulfillment house, too, where the mail would go to get the bracelets put in and the literature that would go with it and all and get mailed out. So it became a massive production. And, of course, we had to hire some grown-ups, and we had an accountant who came to work and was kind of sort of like the CEO, and he ran a lot of things. We had bookkeepers and all like that, and my job really was pretty much with the families, because when I had gone to this meeting of the First League of Families meeting that I went to, the thing that touched me so much and overwhelmed me was here was this group of people who had absolutely nothing in common except they had a loved one who was a prisoner or missing. We had people there, a general and his wife whose son was a pilot and he was missing. We had people I met who were from the hills and were totally, couldn't read and write. And we had to get people to fill out the forms. And the Army had gone to them and gotten them some clothes and packed them up and brought them to Washington so that they could attend this meeting. So it was just an incredible array of people. And I was so empathetic, I guess. I don't know. I was overwhelmed by this group of people. And couldn't imagine what it'd be like. There were a number of wives who were just a few years older than I was, and it really touched me, and I think that kind of motivated me so much. So my work was really more with the families, and I would get the bracelets manufactured in the names they wanted, make sure they got them. We had the League of Families and had these groups of families all over the country that were by this time organized, and we would give them the bracelets on consignment, and they would just give us $2 for every bracelet they got. And so they were able to raise a great deal of money, and that helped them fund their local DOW activities. We, meanwhile, used it to produce literature, bumper stickers, buttons, television PSAs. We had ads on matchbooks, where it used to be when you would buy cigarettes out of a cigarette machine, some matches would come out too. Well, we had POW-MIA-related matches that would come out with information that people could call to sign up to help or something. Really, it brought it to people's attention. And one of the things, too, was that there were so many people who didn't want to be anti-war activists or protesters, but they kind of wanted to be involved somehow. And wearing the bracelet allowed them to hope and pray and talk about it and the man on their bracelet without really getting involved in any political discussion of it or battle about it. And it had an enormous effect on people. People then started wanting to write letters to the families of the men on their bracelet. So we had to set up a whole operation where letters could be sent to us and we would forward them to people. So I had a group of ladies who did nothing all day long but forward mail to the families of the missing men. And then the families were getting so many letters, they actually had to get form letters printed up and biographies and things of their man.
What did all of this say about the mind and the heart of the country at that point?
I think that there are really good people in this country and that people wanted to support the men in uniform. But what was happening and what was on the news was all the anti-war protests. And this gave people a way to be supportive of the servicemen without getting involved, I think, in the argument of should we be in the Vietnam War or not. And I just think there are good people in this country, and that came out.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
And this movement that you started really took control of your life. You dropped out of school, and you went a completely different direction with your life, right?
Yes, I did drop out of school, And, you know, I don't feel I should get credit for really starting it so much. I mean, Kay and I had this inkling of an idea for the bracelets, but, you know, some people came together to make it happen. And then, of course, just hundreds of people working throughout this country that POWMIA issued to draw attention to it. And the bracelets is a way of doing it. They were not always welcome, I have to say. The people in the government, in the White House, were not all that thrilled. They pretty much at that point had the POWMIA wives and the League of Families under their control, and they did not have us under any kind of control, and we had all the money. And they didn't ever know for sure what we would, you know, try to pull or do or whatever, and we weren't going to do anything bad, but sometimes they were led to believe this. And so for a long time, we didn't get too much cooperation from the government at all. I couldn't even get a list of missing men out of them. Now, later on, I did. But in the first year or so, no. The Navy particularly became involved. Admiral Zumwalt appointed someone to be on his staff to be his POWMIA liaison man. And that made a real difference. The Navy actually passed a rule making it okay for sailors to wear the bracelet, which the other services wouldn't let the guys wear them because they weren't part of the official uniform thing. So, you know, there was all kinds of weird things would come up that one would never, ever anticipate. But eventually, most people in the government really were supportive of the issue, and certainly the families, most of the families were too. We had some families that didn't want their men's names on bracelets. Some young girls going, I don't want some teenage girl wearing a bracelet, my husband's name on it. It's like, okay, you know, but most of them were very supportive.
When the war ended and most of our guys, POWs, came home, did you feel like, okay, the cause is over now, or did you realize that we had a much bigger problem?
Well, no, I did not realize, I did not say, oh, the war is over, this is over. Because people that we thought should have come home, that we thought were last known alive and that survived their loss incidences, didn't come home. And it's like, but what happened to them? And the government and the military said, oh, well, we're going to account for all these people within a year. And it turned out that their plan for accounting for all these people within a year was to declare them all dead. And they started out doing that. And so those of us who were working on this issue and the families started fighting back. And meanwhile, of course, the POWs did come home. And in all, they did not really have information on men who were still being held, who did not come home. But we didn't know, as the public, really, we didn't know what the POWs had said, other than if you asked individual POWs, if they knew anything. So the family started a class action lawsuit to stop the status changes to dead. There was a mechanism set up by the government to deal with the Vietnamese and in an accounting process. But then, of course, the POWs came home in 73, and Saigon did not fall until 75. During that two-year period, there were talks going on between the U.S. and the Communist Vietnamese, and all the parties, actually, in dealing with an accounting and all, and we'd have a group of people that would go to Hanoi, and I believe that they did release the bodies of some men who they said had died in captivity somewhere during that period. But still, I mean, we were way short, you know, way over 1,000 people short of an accounting of the missing. the lawsuit went on. Saigon fell. We continued to fight the government. At that point, Viva was sort of slowing down. Gloria Kaufman, for a number of health reasons, wasn't so involved. Some people were kind of taking over that on the board of directors, which was a group of adults that actually ran Viva, that were not sure they wanted to continue on the POW issue. Obviously, fundraising was a serious problem and all. And so I ended up coming to Washington, moving to Washington, D.C., to take a job in the League of Families office. At that point, there was a man who was the father of a missing man, and he was going to be the league director for a year, and I was going to be his assistant. And so I did that. Actually, they hired me for 4 months because they didn't have much money either, and I didn't get paid. I think I got $1,000 a month. So you can see that the scale was not a lot anyway, but I managed to stay throughout all of his tenure, and I ended up being the director of the League of Families then for 2 years.
Did you make a conscious decision that this is not your job, this is a cause that I'm taking on, or did you just kind of slide into it?
I just slid into it. I don't think I made a conscious decision at all. I wanted to work in public relations and publicity, probably for a movie studio or something. That's what I was interested in.
But this movement took control of your life and led you in a completely different direction. Have you ever thought about what if all of these stars hadn't aligned?
I don't know I haven't really thought about what if this hadn't happened so much as how on earth did this happen? Because, again, I never planned for it. Sometimes I think, my gosh, you made an entire career of looking for missing people from that war in Vietnam, and I wasn't even in the war. In 1983, I actually went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency and in their POW MIA office. And they were the ones pretty much tasked with putting together information that would provide leads and our group in Thailand would talk to Vietnamese refugees who had reports that they had seen Americans and stuff. We also had the files on the missing men and started really going through and combing through those and, okay, what happened to this guy? And later on, once the Vietnamese agreed to let the United States come in and start searches with them and interview local people who really did have information on Americans that had often died in their captivity or they had seen the plane shot down and found the remains of the American and maybe buried it locally. And so every case is different, and people sometimes don't understand that, but every case you track what leads you have, and it leads you in a different direction because sometimes the remains were picked up by the North Vietnamese after a period of time, taken to Hanoi. We know they had a warehouse where they actually did store hundreds for a number of years, and sometimes the men were buried locally and people didn't know, but they could lead us to where they were and people in the village would be able to lead us. So you had to track every loss different. And of course, with the aircraft losses more in North Vietnam and in Laos, you could try to find those crash sites. And obviously that would lead you to try to find something there. And you could find equipment from the aircraft, ejection equipment, as they called it life support equipment, but things that the pilot would have been wearing. So even though possibly the man's remains after so many years had totally disintegrated, you could find life support equipment that indicated he was on the aircraft. the guys that in my office that I worked in were great. They taught me how to do map tracking and using geo-coordinates and different things that I was not used to. They would do that. One of my best friends was sat next to me, and she was in charge of collection of intelligence, and she would task the other agencies to collect intelligence we might need or to look for something. And a lot of area imagery of something back at the time of the loss, and you could maybe see something from that. One of the things I mainly did, however, was I could write, and a lot of intelligence analysts can't write worth beans. And one of our problems was communicating with the families, because trying to get them to understand or know what we had and what we knew and what we didn't know. And they would write in, plus members of Congress. So I did a lot of research and preparation of letters and drafting of letters to try to explain. So I worked with the analysts more to explain to a family member or someone or a congressman what had happened to someone. So that was more, I was better fitted to that in a lot of things, because we had some guys, a whole lot of Vietnam veterans in our office who worked well into their 70s and who spoke Vietnamese, knew the area, and they had an enormous advantage over me, certainly, and they could teach me a lot, and I could ask them questions, and like they would talk about, and we would do speeches to the League of Families, and the men would go and brief them and all, and they'd talk about collection, and I'd go, wait a minute, you're talking to a group of people who believe collection is the plate they pass on Sunday in church. You've got to explain to them, when you talk about collection, what you mean, how you collect intelligence, what you do, what kind of things you use, what are the assets at your disposal to the best you could. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot. We couldn't give away sources and methods and things like that. But other than that, the files on the men became totally declassified or sanitized, taking out sources and methods. And the families could all have copies of those. And they also got copies of everything that we were getting out of the field. If there was a field investigation on their case, they would get copies of all the reporting on that. So I always tried to be totally transparent with the families, tried to get the government to be, and it wasn't that they didn't want to be. They just, it didn't occur to them that, you know, oh, we need to tell somebody about this. Is that just how it wasn't how they worked? I mean, so
how did you manage to be professional about your work and to be passionate about this and not let it break your heart when you're dealing with these families?
Oh, well, sometimes it did break my heart. And, you know, I saw families or knew of some who believed things charlatans were telling them and were scamming them and things, and you just couldn't convince them that, hey, you don't want to go that way, because there were some unscrupulous people that would come along and take advantage of some of these people from time to time, and sometimes for no real reason. I mean, they didn't get any money out of it or anything. They would tell them all kinds of fake stories and all. That was probably more heartbreaking than anything. And some of these families that I can remember, some families that there was a fake photograph that got tons of publicity of supposedly three men in captivity. Well, the photograph, I mean, you looked at it and you go, this doesn't look Vietnam era. And I kept saying, this isn't right. This cannot be these people. I mean, there's a million reasons it couldn't be them, but just you could tell by the dressing, the clothing on these men and stuff. And it indeed had been taken, I think, during the Russian Revolution. It wasn't that old, but it was a World War One kind of thing-ish. I mean, it was decades old. And but they wanted to believe that their sons and husbands were alive and wanted to believe this was true. And it was a scam. And there were people in Southeast Asia who would come up with scams and write to families and tell them they knew of their loved one was alive, and often they were looking for a way out of a refugee camp or something, who knows what.
Were you approaching that fine line between being passionate about your job and being obsessed with your job?
Well, yeah, I guess I probably, by most standards, was obsessed with my job. One of my good friends and I, we were dancing around in the office because we were so happy that a man's teeth had been found at a crash site. And that is not something you would really want us to celebrate normally, but it kind of, it solved a case that was of enormous personal interest, I guess, to us, where we knew the family and all. And in our minds, finding the guy's teeth at the crash site pretty much sealed what had happened to him, that he had not gotten out of this aircraft. And the fact that this crash site had been found in a far-off place and many years after the end of the war was an accomplishment by the search teams. So, so sometimes it was weird. And, I was so, I guess, obsessed with the job, too, that I forgot to have a life. I think I mentioned earlier I did not get married until I was 42 years old. So because I was just so busy doing this that I didn't have a whole lot of private life. I had some, but not as much as I should have.
And you met your husband, air show, is that right?
But my husband was head of the contest and records board for the National Aeronautics Association. He was the one who, when you set a world aviation record, he would sanction the record and verify the record. And a woman I knew said, she worked for this organization, and she said, my boss is having an air race out of Dulles, and if we go, it's a thing they're going to do it as in fuel and weight and all, and so they're going to use people to ballast the airplanes, and we can fly around in airplanes. So I went out there and flew around in an airplane of a guy from Southern California and with his girlfriend and another guy in the airplane, and we flew all around in this air race and all, and I met my friend's boss at this race out on the grassy area between strips at the Dulles, on one of the runways at Dulles, and it was her boss, and we knew each other for a number of years, and after 8 years, we got married, so that was a real surprise, but he was quite a lot older than I was, and unfortunately, I lost him 8 years ago, but he was 93 years old. He had a really great life.
Did he appreciate your fascination, your obsession?
Oh, yes, he did. He did indeed, yeah. He did, and I continued to work for a number of years after we were married, and he was home, but when he started getting really shouldn't be home alone, I ended up retiring from. But he was interested. One of his friends was Chuck Yeager, the famous pilot. He knew a number of astronauts, and actually my husband flew in the B-1 bomber when they were doing tests of it to set aviation records before they turned it over to the Air Force. So, it worked out well.
How did you manage to leave all this sadness at the office every day?
I don't think we were really sad every day at the office because we were doing our job. And I think one of the things about the job and one of the things that attracted most of the people who worked there and the people who were successful who worked there was that they were really interested in it and they thought they were doing something useful and good. And it was a job with a purpose, that the results were not often good and it was sometimes a long time between results, but even the saddest results were good in a way because the families wanted to know what had happened to their loved ones. And having the man's remains returned was an enormous relief to an awful lot of people because they knew for sure then what had happened to him. And although he hadn't survived, most of the families understood this. And just having it put to rest To this day, they continue to recover remains and identify them, and it does bring an enormous amount of ending for so many people. And of course, what's sad is so many of the parents are no longer with us and all, but some the children are, and a few wives and things are. But, you know, credit to the League of Families, who really hung in there and stayed there and fought and fought and fought, and to ensure that the government didn't stop, to ensure that the government things got funded so that people could be accounted for, and that equipment for, like, the laboratories to identify people, everything, and getting employee slots in various portions of the government that were involved in the accounting. It's been a long battle, and the League of Families has been right there and pushing all the ways. When I went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency in 1983, I did believe that there were some prisoners still alive, or that their probability. We've had a number of reportings and some of these Rambo-type things going on and all, but there were live sighting reports, as we would call them, coming out of refugees who were leaving Southeast Asia. And I believe that there probably were. And when I went to work there, one of the men in my office asked me if I thought people were alive. I told him yes, and he asked me how many. And I think I told him, well, maybe as many as 50. Throughout the years, then, of course, I had access to all of the intelligence that we collected. I had access to all the missing men's files, because there are some people believe I, quote, sold out to the government and then was involved in a cover-up to hide POWs. And that wasn't the case. I really did have access to everything. And I came to reluctantly conclude that that there were not people still alive. And, I mean, I had POW debriefs and things like this, too. And so, you know, it was sad to realize there weren't people alive, but I'm glad we got them back, and the ones who survived. And we've also then, since then, due to the work of the families and due to the work of the government, been able to account, I think, I don't have the latest figures, but hundreds of men who've been accounted for and their remains have been returned, and that's important. The guy on the bracelet I wore, his body was sent back in the mid-80s, I believe it was, and but at least he was accounted for, and his mother knew that, and that brought her enormous peace and comfort.
What did you learn about yourself out of this decades-long obsession?
Oh, my. I never thought about that. I'm a quiet fighter, I guess. I'm not a great public speaker. I don't like to go out and rant and rave in public, or even particularly speak in public, or do this type of interview. But I quietly work in the background and continue to fight and push and to get what I want, certainly as far as it pertained to this POW/MIA issue, yes. And also, maybe I had a one-track mind, too, that I was so obsessed with it that I didn't think about other things. I know the one thing my parents, when I finally got to work for the government, they were so pleased I got a real job, so that had real benefits or retirement or something, because always before, the jobs had to deal with, well, we got to raise the money in order to keep us here kind of thing. And so, but I don't know. I haven't really thought about it learning so much. I was pleased I was able to grasp so much about the intelligence community as I was going in there with absolutely no background in the intelligence community. They hired me solely because of my POW/MIA background. And there were people in DIA who did not want to hire me, too, because I didn't know anything. And I didn't have a college degree, which was a real no-no. I mean, they did not hire me.
And you don't have a college degree for a kind of ironic reason. you might say.
Right, and I can remember the man in personnel saying, he said, well, what grade did they tell you you would be? Because I dealt with an admiral on being hired, and I said, well, they told me I would be a GS-12. He said, well, we can't do that. You don't even have a college degree. I said, yeah, and you don't hire anybody with this many years of experience in the POW-MIA issue. So I saw him write down GS-12 on the paper, so I figured I was okay. But he had been told, I'm sure. But it was, I guess, somewhat controversial. And DIA was a fairly small agency in those days, too. And this office was under not additionally the direct supervision of the director of the agency, but very much so. The director of the agency would come by and see us, knew us by name, and it was something that got a lot of attention, got a lot of public attention for the agency that didn't want public attention, so which was one of the reasons I was there, was to help them in deal with the families and the congressmen and stuff.
Do you ever go to the wall?
I have been on various occasions early on when it first was put up. I haven't been in recent years, no. But when it was first started, and certainly the dedication of it, the completion of it, coming with friends who were visiting Washington and various people, I did in the early years it was there, yes.
And very. How did it affect you?
Oh, it's very moving. And I think one of the reasons it works and one of the reasons the bracelet works, and I was thinking that today watching the September 11th stuff, because it has the people's names on it, it makes it personal. If you just had a giant memorial thing, it would not be maybe quite as stunning. But this one has names of all the people on it, and it makes it real. And that's why the bracelets worked, because of the names, and that's why that memorial works.
You made POWs real for a lot of people in the early 70s. When you encounter someone today who still has a bracelet, how does it make you feel?
I think the first thing I do is get a big smile on my face. There's a lady that works at the local Trader Joe's here who has a bracelet on. And when I first saw her with it a few years ago, it was like, oh my goodness, you have an original POW bracelet. And she goes, oh yes, I've had this all the time. And I say, do you know about the guy whose name is on it? And she said, yes. And I knew the family lived in Virginia, and she had been in touch with them. And I believe he's still missing. But every now and then, I haven't been to a grocery store in a while, but I would go in there and see her with the bracelet still. So, and occasionally I run into someone with a bracelet. Not too often, but occasionally.
You helped a lot of people achieve closure. Did you achieve closure for yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was really proud and pleased to be a part of the effort from early on, from the public affairs thing, and then work for as many years as I did in the Pentagon for 22 years on the POW issue, on the accounting issue, and to really feel that I'd given it about all I could for as long as I could on that issue. So I think I don't know what more I could have done. I kind of came to the end of the road, and for personal reasons, I really needed to come home to be with my husband. So I chose that, but I really felt good about it. I have friends still work on this issue every day. Ann Griffiths, who's head of the League of Families, and we are so close friends. I talk to her once a week at least. So I'm still aware of what's going on generally and interested in what's going on, but I think my contributions to it were really kind of over.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life. and audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.